You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. And now, here's today's message.
Let's go before the Lord in prayer. Father, I come before you this evening, and I pray for your grace and for your strength and for your wisdom. Give us your presence tonight as we discuss this important topic of parenting. In Christ's name, amen. So this is our 11th and our final lesson in our series on parenting. And so we began with four lessons on the foundations of parenting. So the mission of parenting, shepherding a child's hearts. We talked about here's where we're headed, here's what we're trying to accomplish. Then we talked about the shaping of children, influences on them, the orientation that comes out of them. We talked about the authority of parents, the nature of that authority, and what it looks like to exercise it well. And then we talked about parenting goals. And so those were the foundations that we began with. And then we had four lessons on methods for parenting. So we talked about introduction. We want to discard unbiblical methods and develop consistency and discover communication. So we started there. Then we had another lesson that really focused on communication. And we need to have many different types of communication, not just discipline and correction. We need lots of types of communication with our children. And we need to count the cost of a life of communication and also count the blessings that can come when we pour ourselves into our children and have this rich and full orbed life of communication with them. And then we talked, methods part three is correction. And of course, the rod is primary there, but also, especially as children get older, there's consequences that come, and learning how to shift between the rod and consequences is very important. And in both of those things, whether we're using the rod or we're using a consequence, we need to appeal to their conscience. And so that's the methods in terms of correction. And then methods part four, finishing out that section, is equipping. The goal of our parenting is to prepare our children for the day of judgment and to equip them for the day of reward. So we aren't just training our children not to be cast out. We need to equip them to hear well done. That's our goal. It isn't enough to train them to avoid God's judgment. We want to equip them to labor for God's glory. We raise them in the fear of the Lord so that they may live lives of fruitfulness for the Lord. Fruitfulness for the Lord, that's what we are aiming for. We need to remember, our goal is not to raise well-behaved children. That's not the goal. If that's what you're aiming at the wrong thing. Our goal is to train up effective and faithful adults. We are to bring up children, which means we need to allow them to be children, but we must not allow them to stay children. The goal is to bring them from an obedient childhood to an effective adulthood. And if we're going to do that, then we need to give attention to this matter of equipping. So our goal isn't to manage tolerable children, but to equip adults for excellence. So that's, we began with the foundations. We moved on to the methods. In the final section of the course, three lessons on the seasons of parenting. And so we began by talking about the season of infancy from around, birth, when they are born, to around 4 or 5 years old. And the training goals for this season are to teach them the principle of authority. They need to know that there is authority in the world, and they are not it. They need to learn they are not the center of the universe. They are not in charge of the universe. The universe does not revolve around them. God is in charge. And the reason you are in charge of them is because God has put you in charge. So they must learn this principle of authority. And of course, the primary training procedure to teach them this principle of authority, to drive out the folly of self-governance, that self-governance is an appropriate way to understand that, but to drive out the folly that thinks that they are in charge of the world, is the rod. That's what God's given us. And so we talked about training goals for this season, training procedures for this season. In our last lesson, a few weeks ago now, we talked about childhood. And in the season of childhood, which lasts from whenever they exit infancy, let's say 4, 5, 6, around there, it can vary child to child, to around when they hit puberty at 11, 12, or 13. So this childhood season, let's say from 5 to 12, the goal is to begin to instill character and to recognize that compliance to your authority is not the same thing as character. And so we need to assess their character, assess the child in relationship to God, to himself, to others. We need to regularly take stock of where their character is actually at. And we have some training procedures for this season as well. Addressing the heart, appealing to the conscience, shaping the narratives that they use to frame their worlds, because we are narratival creatures, and so we need to pay attention to the stories that are shaping the way they see the world. And we need to learn to interpret their behavior not in terms of compliance or non-compliance, but in terms of the character that it reveals, so we can shepherd their hearts towards the character that they ought to have. We need to have a long-term vision, see beyond short-term frustrations to the long-term character we're hoping to instill. Finally, in this our last lesson, we come to the season of launching, which is from the teenage years till the time that they leave the home. So from puberty to adulthood, generally in our culture, we consider this the years of 12 through 18. One of the key characteristics of this season is that teenagers begin to wrestle with a way of dealing with the world for themselves. So a two-year-old, we talked about this, wants to get water for herself. But no healthy two-year-old worries about who's going to pay the water bill. No healthy five-year-old worries about that. No healthy 10-year-old worries about that. But teenagers do begin to think in those terms. They begin to see the weight of responsibilities that exist in the world that we live in. So when you have a young child, even when a young child lashes out in rebellion at their parents, they are still completely dependent on them, not only economically, but also and especially psychologically. A young child can't process the world on their own. They must have parents to help them do that. But in the teen years, that begins to change. And teens begin to wrestle with what it looks like to encounter the world for themselves. And so because of that, they're prone to vulnerability, wondering if they will be accepted. Because for the first time, their life is dependent, to some extent, on whether they're accepted by their peers or by others, and they're very concerned about that. They're prone to anxiety, wondering if they'll be able to perform because they're expected to in various areas of life. They're prone to instability, wondering how to put the world together. These are things that ought to be in to come in the teen years. They're challenges, but they're the challenges that come with growing up. And the flip side of all of this instability in the teen years is they are also the years when a child begins to make commitments and decisions that have sticking power and come with lasting consequences. When Petey comes to me and tells me that he has decided what his life is going to look like, I take him seriously. I take him sincerely. I'll even get him a book on whatever topic it is. But I don't really take it that seriously. Because the fact is, it's one thing this month, and it's something else the month before, and it's something else the month before that. Children go through phases like that all the time. And that's normal. And we don't count that against them. But when children come to be teenagers, the phases they go through can change the course of their life. If a child announces that they have decided on a particular political position, it's not that big a deal. It doesn't really matter who they want to win the primary or the election. But if a 16-year-old, let's go back to the 50s, if a 16-year-old decided to canvass for the Communist Party in the 1950s in America, that would have lasting consequences. And in a similar way, if a 16-year-old decided to sneak out and take part in a neo-Nazi rally, that would have consequences in a way that expressing a political preference as a child would not have. If your 8 or 9 or 10-year-old rebels against bedtime, that's going to come with consequences in the context of your home, or at least it should, but it's not going to radically alter the course of their life. If a teenager decides to rebel and have sex with their boyfriend or girlfriend that they have against the parents' will, that could produce a child and radically alter the course of their life. If a child decides they don't like math, you make them do math. It doesn't matter whether they like it or not. But if a teenager decides they're not going to finish high school, that radically alters the course of the rest of their lives because they flunk out of high school. And now, all of a sudden, their career options have been limited. Above all, the teen years are years of increasing independence. So there are years of instability, there are years of increasing consequences, and there are years, more positively, of increasing independence. The teen years are years in which children begin to imagine themselves apart from their parents. And this is a good thing. It's part of God's design for children. But like everything that God designed, it can be broken by sin. And all too often, the realization of themselves as individuals for the first time, in a real way, can turn into open rebellion. And most of the time, teenage rebellion is simply the flourishing of seeds of bitterness that were sown a long time ago, but only now have the opportunity to come out into the light. Tripp says this: when a child is young, he may feel rebellious at times. He may express defiance on occasion. But as long as he is very young and totally dependent upon mom and dad, he cannot openly rebel. He still needs mom and dad. They still have too much power. However, once he can imagine living on his own without his parents, he begins to give expression to his rebellion. And that word that he uses, imagine, is actually very significant. Because it's not as though a 12 or 13-year-old can actually live independently of their parents very easily. If they go out on the street and they try to live on their own, they will be picked up by a pseudo-parent who will not take care of them. They can't actually live on their own. But they can imagine what it looks like to live independently of their parents, what that would feel like. They can process that, and that radically changes things. However, once he can begin imagine living on his own without his parents, he begins to give expression to his rebellion. Parents often seem to be taken by surprise when actually the rebellion has been dormant for years. And in the book, he gives some examples of what this looks like, of a child whose parents seem to be in control, but it was obvious there were seeds of rebellion that were being sown in their hearts that came to fruition as soon as they were able to come up. So, as a question, do you discern any rebellion in your older children, for those of you who have older children, that may be linked to earlier mistakes in your parenting? Or you could flip the question, what would be some mistakes one could make in earlier parenting that could sow seeds of rebellion in older children? What can you do to open discussion of those things to maybe do a course correction before it's too late? Any takers on any of those questions before we move on? Or any questions about what we've covered up to this point? Pastor Scott.
One of the examples in the book was publicly shaming your child in front of other people when they're young. And I thought that was good, because then that just harbors bitterness. So you won't see the rebellion when they're young, but when they're older and they can push back, it manifests itself more.
Yep. Yeah, that's a really crucial one. Shaming your children. You think you can control them by shame now, but you're just sowing seeds of bitterness that'll reap a bad harvest later on. That's really good, Pastor Scott. Brother Rogers.
Just general harshness. I got saved when I was 30, and I already had some children. Mm-hmm. And so then I swung way far the other way, and it was like, you know, every little thing. Like, correct, 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 correct. And I'm still reaping some of that today. And it's hard, as Pastor Scott says, sometimes that doesn't come out till they're much older. And it's unfortunate, because you don't know that that's those seeds of bitterness or that damage to the relationship is there. Because kids are so, they seem forgiving when they're little. And then you don't realize until they're older that how much resentment they have toward you.
And I think that could be helpful even to get feedback from others, to ask people to observe, because people who have been down that road may be able to observe that all is not as well as it seems to you. That actually there's going to be some bad fruit that's going to come up. And so dealing with it now while you can still repent and then show that you've changed is helpful. Carson?
I know that being overly harsh thing, I know it definitely does breed. I know that growing up until I was about 11 years old, my father was overly harsh on me in a lot of ways. A lot of it was out of fear for me. My brother has special needs, and I think he kind of had a fear, like when I was younger, that I didn't want me to become like him. So every little mistake that I made, he made a big deal out of it. He sees that now, but he thankfully, when I was like 10 or 11, he started to realize that, and he told me that he was sorry, and he changed a lot of that. But you don't want to lose all of that. Obviously, you still have to have firmness of a father, but I definitely could see how an entire childhood, all the way up to where you move out of that, could really breed a lot of bitterness.
Yeah. I meant to ask you, Chad, when you realized that, what did you do? Because obviously, you've maintained a good relationship with your older children. So, what steps did you take when you realized that to help, make a course correction?
Yeah.
Sorry for putting you on the spot, but...
No, it's just making sure... having a lot more grace, and I didn't have a lot of grace in my parenting when I was my wife is whispering in my ear, neither one of us, and so you mentioned the communication, communicating a lot more with our children as they're growing, even though obviously the children need correction when they're young, more of the rod and that kind of thing, but making sure to have that focus on having that communication with your children as they're growing, so that that is natural as they're adults or close to it. And that's kind of how the things that we changed.
Connie?
With our older kids, we realized and we made that difference, and we are good friends with them, and we love them to pieces. But then what happened with our parenting was we swung the other way, and we are too easy on our younger children, and so then we're dealing with that. So we saw along the way what was going on with our olders and made that difference, and we have, like I said, just that bond with them, but still keeping the little ones little and helping them to see that they still have to obey. They're not Gavin, Greta. They're not George. They cannot go to a party. They can't do these certain things. And so they sometimes are like, well, why can't we stay up that late? And so just explaining to them, you're not at that stage in age yet, and that's okay. So.
Yeah, that's really hard when you have a large family and the older kids can do stuff that you're tempted to just say, oh, yeah, but then that can breed bitterness when it was a big deal to the older kids that they couldn't do that. And then the little kids just get a pass, and they can feel like, well, what's the big deal with all these rules anyways? Why don't I just forget the rules you're telling me now? That can be kind of that. That can be a danger. All right. Good discussion. We better move on, though. The teen years are years in which you can no longer overpower your children. So it's not just the children that are changing. They're becoming more independent. The consequences for their independence is increasing. They have all of these things happening to them, but your relationship to them is changing as well. Here's the fact. If your teenagers don't love and respect you to some extent, there is nothing you can do to make them. If you don't have some trust, you can't make them obey you. You can make an 8-year-old obey you. You can make a 10-year-old obey you. If your 15-year-old doesn't respect you, the game's up. Because the fact is, it doesn't matter if you live in a blue state or a red state or a purple state or a blue and dot or, pink polka dot state. If your teens want to get out of your house, they can call CPS and leave you playing high-stakes Russian roulette, no matter what state you live in. Your teens can ruin your life and theirs like that. And if they don't respect you enough by the time they're teens to not do that, you have little to no recourse other than praying for a miracle. That's why, when our children are still young, we should always make discipline a matter of authority rather than power. So we talked about this distinction when we talked about young children. You should discipline out of authority, not out of power. Your children need to be taught that they must obey you because God puts you in charge, not because you're bigger, stronger, smarter, wealthier, whatever, than them. Because if you make it a matter of power, you will not always have that power. So begin with the end in mind. Don't crush the spirit of your young children, and don't be discouraged when they show some spirit in inappropriate ways. We don't want docile children, or even easy ones, at least I don't. If you want your teenagers to be difficult for the devil to digest, then you need to be prepared for toddlers that are a little difficult for you to tame. And so, with this matter of discipline in our relationship to them, we want to raise children that are, we want to raise teenagers and young adults that are dangerous for the devil. Well, we're going to have some children that are difficult, but we're going to have to bring those children not under power, but under authority, so that when they're older, and you can't control them through power, they respect your authority, and they're willing to submit even when they disagree. This matter of power and control, power versus authority, is Rachel Jacobitz has a quote. It's a little longer than I would usually read, but it's so helpful. If you don't maintain your authority, and this is talking about how to deal with children in the younger years so that you can prepare them for when they become older children and teenagers. If you don't maintain your authority but start grabbing for power and control, you'll simply end up being like an electric dog collar to your children. Aside from your little exertions of power, they can see no reason why they should still be in the backyard. You may successfully limit their activities to the area you set out, but they will not have embraced the boundaries. Take this a little further down the road. What happens when they leave your house? Will they be up in the neighbor's chicken coop in a heartbeat? On the other hand, maybe, and this is where that too, you know, difficult children, but also authority versus control comes in. Maybe all the shocks from the collar just led them to believe that life everywhere is pointless and not worth pursuing. But that is still not a disciplinary success. If the dog stays on the porch forever without any particular loyalty to it, you have a different kind of problem and a boring one too. There's a very important distinction between authority and power, and your authority should always be geared toward guiding with an eye towards releasing. Power never wants to let go and always grabs for more. An example might be if your child goes off and misbehaves at a friend's house, you respond with a power grab. You can't have a snack now. I won't let you play with your Nintendo now. Now you can't have a friend over. Discipline like this is about control and not authority. This is why you see parents who start cracking down harder and harder as the kids get older and older. If you're disciplining in a power regime, you'll find that if you give an inch, they take a mile. Give your daughter money to go shopping and she'll come home with things you never would have bought. Give your son the keys to the car and he'll prove to you what a bad idea that was. This is because every little gap in your power is like a hole in the electric fence, offering them a chance at freedom. This might leave the parents with the impression they ought to tighten up, but what they ought to have done was loosen up a long time ago. As our children we ought to be releasing them from our authority to God's authority alongside us. Our authority is given to prepare them for liberty. It's not given to control them. And that's the difference between power and authority. We've been given the authority to raise them for the time when the fences will be taken away. We're trying to teach them how to be responsible adults. And we don't want them to conclude that life is not worth living because they're going to get shut down anyways. That would be crushing their spirit. We don't want them to have no idea what to do if they don't have a rule for it. We want to raise young men and young women of deep character that have a deep joy and a zest for life. but who have the control to stay out of the chicken coop. If they're a dog looking to, you know, eat feathers, that they know what is good and what is dangerous, what is helpful and what is harmful, and they have a desire to pursue good. That's what we're aiming for. So these are some things, some of the changes. So our goal in this season of launching is to prepare them for independence. So that is the primary goal of this season. So they are becoming more independent, whether we like it or not. We want to prepare them for responsible independence. And so perhaps if we were to pick just one word for this season of what we're aiming at, it would be responsibility. So with our youngest children, our infants, we're trying to teach them about authority. When our children get a little older, we're trying to teach them about character. When they become not children anymore, but young men and young women, we're introducing them to responsibility. You should not give responsibility to your infants. You should be very careful about giving responsibility to young children, only within careful controls where the consequences aren't going to be too high. But with teenagers, you need to equip and prepare them for responsibility, because like it or not, there's going to be consequences for the decisions that they make. And so introducing them to responsibility is what your job is, taking the controls away and letting them deal with the consequences, taking the controls away, letting them deal with the consequences, so that by the time they're ready to leave your home, they are fully functioning adults who can stand beside you and fight beside you and serve and love beside you and start homes of their own. In the season of childhood, the key lesson is character. In the season of launching, the key goal is laying a firm foundation for an independent, responsible life. And in Proverbs 1, 7 through 17, we find a threefold foundation on which our teens and young adults, teens, that is, young adults, can root their lives in. Proverbs 1, 7, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. My son, hear the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the law of thy mother. For they shall be an ornament of grace unto thy head, and chains about thy neck. My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. If they say, come with us, let us lay wait for blood, let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them up alive as the grave, and whole as those that go down into the pit. We shall find all precious substance, we shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in thy lot among us, let us all have one purse. My son, walk not thou in the way with them. Refrain thy foot from their path, for their feet run to evil and make haste to shed blood. Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. And though they wait for their own blood, they lurk privily for their own lives. So are the ways of every one that is greedy of gain, which taketh away the life of the owners thereof." Now there are three foundations of life in this passage. Tripp says this: the fear of the Lord, verse 7. Adherence to parental instruction, verses 8 through 9. And disassociation from the wicked, verses 10 through 19. So there are three foundations: fear of the Lord, adherence. We'll talk about the significance. It sounds like sort of a complicated, difficult word, but there's a reason why Tripp uses that word, and I think it's a very helpful one. So fear of the Lord, adherence to parental instruction, and disassociation from the wicked. These are the three foundations. We're trying to teach them how to be independent and responsible, or responsibly independent, we could put it that way. And so the three foundations for responsible independence: fear of the Lord, adherence to parental instruction, and disassociation from the wicked. First, the fear of the Lord. Proverbs 1:7. "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." Your teenager must be motivated by a sense of awe and reverence for God. Tripp says this: "You want the choices he makes to reflect a growing comprehension of what it means to be a God worshiper. Living in fear of God means living in the realization of accountability to him. It is living in light of the fact that he is God and we are creatures. He sees all, everything is open before him. Living in godly fear means living in full light of God as a holy God who calls his people to holiness. Make it a point to read through the major and minor prophets with your children during their teen years." This is a continuation. It's a little bit of a longer quote from Tripp, but I think it's really helpful. "Your children are part of a contemporary evangelical culture that suffers from a low view of God." That's the air we breathe, even as Christians, a low view of God. "Reading the prophets confronts you with a holy God who is awesome and prepared to hold his people to account. I have talked to my teens about the need for a bumper sticker to counterbalance this popular smile, God loves you, which is true. This one could say, and be equally true, tremble, God is a consuming fire. And that's what your teens need to know, that God is a consuming fire, and they'd best take him seriously. But it's not just knowing this truth that will root them. It's practically living it out. Because most professing Christian teens who fornicate, as many professing Christian teens do, they know that they ought not to be doing that. They're not confused. They don't suffer from a lack of instruction. But they're more afraid of being rejected by their boyfriend or girlfriend. They're more afraid of being thought uncool or square or whatever terms are used these days. They're more afraid of saying no to the desires of their flesh than they are of God. That's why. They know what to do, and they do the opposite. They have no fear of God. Or rather, they have fear of God, but God is not their greatest fear. They have some fear of the Lord, but they're more afraid of being lonely or unwanted or denying themselves or being an outcast or whatever it is than they are of the Lord. And in countless situations, whether it be in the backseat of a car, whether it be when they're tempted to cheat on an important exam, when they're tempted to go along with fools who laugh at the Lord at the first job, whatever it may be, these situations where they are faced with temptation, it's the fear of the Lord that will deliver them from destruction. Root them, therefore, in the fear of the Lord by teaching, by application, and most importantly, by example in your own life. So here's some questions for you. Are you comfortable with helping your child to see God as awesome and fearful? How can you explore the implications of Hebrews 12:29, which states that our God is a consuming fire? Pardon me, sorry about this. Anything on that question? Are you comfortable with helping your child to see God as awesome and fearful? Anyone? Let's try another question. Are you willing to share your personal experience as a venue for helping your kids think about God's ways? Specifically, when it comes to the fear of the Lord, are you willing to share stories of when God worked on you in judgment to help your children have an appropriate fear of the Lord? Because the only stories that will give your children an appropriate fear of the Lord that are personal stories are probably stories that are going to make you look not the greatest. Which can be a tough thing to do, as Carson just pointed out. What would it look like to do that? What would be some stories we could even share with them about how God is a consuming fire and has demonstrated that in our lives? Abby.
Okay, I'm going to try to say a story like from when I was a teenager. But I, like all teenagers do, went through like that depressing period where I was like super depressed and nothing was working out and I was so sad and I had just been broken up with and then I was broken up with again and I was all sad and depressed and I was just taking it upon myself just to be like all like sad and I would run away and I'd just be doing all these acts of like self-loathing and sad selfishness, stuff like that. And I remember one night I was so sad that I had just like destroyed my room. I'd run away. I just did all these acts of just selfishness and sadness. And I, in my mind, was like thinking how I was just so hurt. Like my heart was just like, I was just so hurt and no one understood and no one saw me and I was all alone and no one cared and all that stuff. And my mom, I came into the kitchen and my mom had, this is by the way a story I'd share with my kids, by the way. And I'd gone to the kitchen and I was just all sappy. And my mom was so sick of it that she just took me by like the collar of my shirt. She just grabbed me like to the point that I was like very uncomfortable and like choking pretty much. And she pulled me to like her nose and my nose and she talked so loud and strongly at me that she was spitting in my face. Sorry, Mom. But basically she just was like, And she said, "You are so selfish. You are not the center of the world." And it just, ever since, like, it resonated through my life just when she did that. She just grabbed me. And I wasn't viewing it like I was so selfish. Or I wasn't viewing it like I was this or that. And I understand this is maybe not touching so much on the fear of God, but what it did do was it shaped the fact that I wasn't the center of the world, and God was. And the fact that when I closed my eyes in that moment and I opened them again, I saw all my siblings, which I have 5 siblings. I have 4 brothers and a sister. I saw my dad and my mom, and I saw God in a different way for the first time, that I was not all lonely and sad and alone. God was there the whole time shaping and doing all that. And my mom was willing to take me, shake me, and tell me how selfish I was, which was hard to hear as a teenager, but it shaped me to realize, like, yeah, I was just being selfish. And it radically changed the way I looked at everything. And so that was just like a personal testimony, just like how parents, when you are able to, like, get in your kids' grill, like, it's effective. And also, I'd love to show it with my kids one day, if ever they're struggling with something like that, to show them that God is the center of the world and you're not.
Yeah, well, I think that would be even an example of the story you just told from your point of view, that, hey, there was a point when I was selfish and self-centered and all the world looked like it was falling apart, but in fact, I was the one who needed to see things differently. And so just being able to share that with your kids, that, hey, you know, right now it looks to you like this is how the world looks, but I know what it looks like to look at the world through the wrong color glasses. And that could be really helpful and liberating to them to realize, like, oh, you know, I'm not surrendering, like I'm not condemning myself to perpetual childhood by recognizing that I saw things wrong, because here's my mom, and she admits that she saw things wrong, and so maybe this is the path to maturity, because that's something teens are very concerned about, that they don't want to be a child forever, and so helping them see, this is how I came to maturity, can be really helpful and liberating.
I wanted to also add that my mom's life and her story, she told me her story over and over through my teen years, and her life is far beyond, I mean, what she had to go through, and that really shaped me too. And then also, the last thing, just to add to that testimony so everyone knows, I had gone back to my bedroom that night, and my brothers had cleaned my entire room and organized my whole room, and my sister, and they put pictures and things to tell me how much they love me. And aww. So, I mean, that takes
now
a
you're going to make me choke up.
Yeah.
So that's the first foundation. Oh, Brother Nate.
So if you've experienced the destruction, like the results, the destructive results of your sin, and actually learned, like, from it and experienced, like the consuming fire, you know, or whatever, like God's judgment on your sin in some practical way in your life, and it's been mitigated by his mercy, right? So you've experienced his judgment, but his mercy at the same time. And if you've actually learned from it and you love your children, then it's a really natural thing to, like, be able to tell them. It's like, if you don't want to do that, then it says that one of those two things doesn't happen. Like, you either didn't learn from it, or you don't love your kids.
Like, yeah. That's really good. And I think sometimes we didn't learn as much as we want to say that we did, and we don't want to revisit those lessons because we're afraid that we actually may have more to learn from them. And that's really... And I think one of the things, too, is when we're open with one another and we have genuine community with one another, and we know, hey, when Brother Nate was a young man, he struggled with this sort of thing. And when Pastor Peter was a young man, he struggled with this sort of thing. And so you can say... that, hey, you're struggling with being tempted to go in this direction, go talk to Brother Nate. Or you're struggling with this direction, you know, that I was very socially awkward. I'm still socially awkward to some extent. But as a young person, it was much more extreme. And I will not tell you all the stories of that. But there was a lot of that. And as a result of that, I tended to act like a buffoon so that at least if people were laughing at me, they'd be doing it under my control as opposed to, you know, their control. Well, I found out the hard way is a very dumb way to live life. And so when we know these stories about one another, which can be embarrassing to share, than when our children are struggling, and maybe we didn't struggle with what they're struggling with, then we can say, hey, go talk to this person, go talk to that person, go talk to Abby. You know, you're all moody and depressed. She's going to give you a what for. It's a bad way to live. Don't do that, right? And so we can be a resource to one another to help bring our children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And not just bring them up to be well-behaved children, but to be well-equipped adults. Kimberly.
Not yet.
Good? Okay.
Yeah, you're good.
Just a second, Abby and you. One of our first pastors that we ever kind of talked on the subject, his biggest encouragement was, do your children know your testimony? And yep. That can be toned down depending on your history and your past. But he's like, do your children know your salvation story and God's story through that continually? And don't hide that from them at all, kind of thing, was the biggest encouragement that he could give to parents. And so we do the same thing with our children. They know versions, and as they continue to get older, they get more and more detail as they grow in age. But, you know, those examples to learn from mom and dad's mistakes and things like that.
Yeah, and it's not just like what I think the story that, you know, the way you're envisioning, like if you had, you know, sins or whatever and you came from a place of brokenness, but it's all of us come from a place of brokenness. It just looks different. And so it may be, don't be afraid to tell your children of just how self-righteous you were when you came to faith, or of how much you've struggled with doubt and discouragement and even despair. Whatever it may be, tell your testimony to your children and let them know that, you know, you're not just a perfect little Christian. It took time for you to get to where you are, and it'll take time to get them to where they need to be. Tawny?
So we always felt exactly the same, and so we shared that with our kids, and now seeing our kids feel free to be able to share those things with their friends or, you know, as people are struggling, like, hey, my mom went through this or that, and knowing that, like, it's okay to share those things. That's our past. That's not who we are today, and that's where God has brought us from. And they don't have to be the same exact struggles, honestly. Like, our kids know that there's an openness to be able to talk about things. Yeah. Even if we didn't deal with that sin, we still are ready to hear it, and we're still ready to listen to them or, you know, be there for them to pray with them. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, it doesn't have to be. I think what you're saying is so important. Your struggle doesn't have to be their struggle for the fact that you struggled to encourage them to be open about the struggles that they face. So the first foundation is the fear of the Lord. The second foundation is adherence to parental instruction. And this is found in verses 8 through 9. My son, hear the instruction of thy father and forsake not the law of thy mother, for they shall be an ornament of grace unto thy head and chains about thy neck. The same theme is dealt with in more detail in Proverbs 6, 20 through 23. My son, keep thy father's commandment and forsake not the law of thy mother. Bind them continually upon thine heart and tie them about thy neck. When thou goest, it shall lead thee. When thou sleepest, it shall keep thee. When thou awakest, it shall talk with thee. For the commandment is a lamp, and the law is light, and reproofs of instruction are the way of life. Now, I mentioned this language of adherence to parental instruction sounds a little odd, but it's actually quite crucial. We've talked about this a little bit already, a little bit of foreshadowing, getting ahead of ourselves a bit. But when our children are infants, it's a simple matter of authority. Are they going to defy you or submit to you? And if you do things right, you can force your children to submit to you. When the young children, it's a matter of character. Are they going to obey when you aren't watching them? By that point, you should have the authority issue well under control. If you have an 8 or 9-year-old who openly defies you, you are in big trouble and you have a lot of remedial work to do. But they need to learn how to carry out the principles that you've taught them when you're not with them. That's a matter of character. When they are teenagers, it's a matter of adherence. Are they going to make your principles their principles, or are they going to choose a different set of principles? Now, it's important to see that this isn't a matter of mere authority, because teenagers could submit to your authority and completely reject your principles. They could submit to your authority and completely reject your principles. This happens in a good way when a teenager comes to faith from an unbelieving home. If you have a Christian teenager who has unbelieving parents, they still must submit to the authority of their parents. The fact that their parents are unbelievers does not remove their authority over those young adults. And so we teach them. The principles of atheism are bad principles, but your parents are still your parents, and you must submit to their authority. But that doesn't only work one way. It can also happen that you have young people living in the home who submit to your authority, and they even know how to put your principles into practice in different settings when you're not with them because they have good character, but at heart, they reject those principles. Jesus is not their Lord. The only reason they're doing what you say is because they have a basic amount of respect for you, but their life is not being built on the foundation that your life is built on. They could keep the rules and apply them well and still reject the principles. And as soon as they leave home, it seems like everything has changed. Everything has not changed. The fact is, they never embrace those principles as their own to begin with. They never deliberately chose to root their own life in those principles. And we need to lead our children to the best of our ability. Ultimately, they're going to have to make these choices for themselves. But our goal with our young adults is to see them embrace biblical principles for themselves. The principles we've taught them, we want those principles to become their principles as far as in us lies. And as a side note, because of this, because we're trying to get them to embrace these principles for themselves, we should not freak out when our teens don't adopt every single one of our current views as their own. After all, when you were their age, you didn't embrace every single one of your current views either. If you still think everything exactly the same as you did when you were 16, we need to have a talk. Hopefully. Now, if you're 16, that's fine. If you're 17, that's not so bad. If you're 36 and your views have not matured since you were 16, I don't think you were that mature of a 16-year-old. And I'll leave you to envision the alternative. And I think better things of you. I don't think there's anyone here who would fit into that category, though there are some adults in the world who do. But that's a topic for another day. Here's the point, though. Your job is not to make your children your clone. Your job is to help them sort out what is foundational from what is incidental, not based on what is convenient for you, but based on what is genuinely best for them. And that means they're going to have to experiment a little bit in determining what exactly is foundational or not. And every time they try out a hairstyle or a genre of music or a political view or a career path that's not lockstep in what you would envision as being the wisest, don't freak out like they've abandoned Jesus. Respond to their bad ideas. Just remember how many bad ideas you had when you were 16. I don't know about you. When I was 16, I had a lot of bad ideas. Just really a lot of them. And probably you did too. So don't treat every bad idea like it's going to destroy their lives. Save the passion and the emotion for the things that really will destroy their lives, because some of the ideas they come up with will destroy their lives. Balance your response. And sometimes you need to actually think of negotiable issues that would allow your young adults to express their independence from you in ways that are constructive, right? They're trying to figure out how to be independent from you, and that's a good thing. There are constructive ways, there are destructive ways, and there are ways that are merely embarrassing or annoying. So if you find something that's merely in the embarrassing or annoying category, you might want to embrace it. Or even help them to pursue it as an alternative to embracing a way of showing independence that will bring total destruction to their lives. What are some, and this is a question from the book, what are some negotiable issues that would enable your teen to express his independence from you in constructive ways? So what are some helpful ways that we could actually encourage young adults to express independence in a way that doesn't destroy the foundations of their life? Tani?
Wearing their hair differently than you would or your spouse would.
Yeah, I think that is not going to ruin their life. And that's probably more constructive than getting a face tattoo or something that's a lot more permanent. Like, hair grows. I mean, at some point, for some of us, it stops growing back. But, you know, that's way in the distance for most of our teens. So, you know, if they want to do something strange with their hair, they'll probably survive. So that would be something where it's like, hey, they're trying to express independence. This is a pretty safe area to do it in. Now, if they ask our advice, we should be honest with them. No, sweetie, that does not look great. But we don't have to be like, you're not going out of the house with a hairdo like that. That's probably not helpful because, like, if you lose the relationship with them, it is going to do more harm than good. Anybody else? All right. First principle, first foundational thing is the fear of the Lord. The second is learning adherence to parental instruction and making your foundations their foundations, even as they, you know, you have negotiable issues that are not actually part of the foundation. The third one is disassociation from the wicked. This is found in verse 10, and then it's spelled out in the rest of the chapter, which we won't read the rest of the chapter a second time. But verse 10 says this, "My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not." Don't go along with the wicked. The teen years are years of competing allegiances. When your child is six, there aren't many who are whispering in his or her ear, come live in my house instead. If we find out about someone who's doing that, an adult who's doing that with one of our young children, we know how to deal with them. And I won't put that on the tape. When your child is 16, it's not a tape, it's a stream, I suppose. No, we actually don't have tapes anymore. All right. When your child is 16, there are hundreds of voices competing for his or her allegiance. And some of those voices have the power to make some very alluring promises. And the older they get, the harder it is, and the less beneficial it is to shut those voices out. You have to teach them not to give heed to them. Tripp says this, "While what I have written above is true, it fails to catch the genius of this passage. The passage doesn't simply tell us to disassociate with the wicked. It also tells us why our children are attracted by such alliances. In verses 10 through 19 of this chapter, there are over 20 collective pronouns. Note these with me. Come along with us. We will get all sorts of plunder. Throw in your lot with us. We will share a common purse." Over and over again. So what is the pitch to the young person in Proverbs 1? It is belonging. The attraction of giving in to the wicked is camaraderie. The appeal is to a very human need to share mutuality with others. Your kids need to belong, and the most powerful way to keep your children from being attracted by the offers of camaraderie from the wicked is to make your home an attractive place to be and to belong. And so we need to provide homes in which our teenagers feel loved and accepted for who they are, weird hair and all. Strange political views and all. And our homes need to be a place where their friends are welcome. Even if at times we wish they would pick different friends. You can lay down the law, but there's a limited benefit to laying down the law for a 17-year-old who has only a few months before they can join the Navy and go to the Philippines and do whatever they want. So we need to think of ways, and I wanted to have a discussion of this, but we need to keep going. We need to think of ways that we can provide a sense of belonging and purpose and mission to our children so that that camaraderie that the wicked offer is there at home and more so. and not just at home, but other venues where there are safe and healthy ways for them to belong, and for them to have friends, and for them to have responsibility, and for them to reap rewards from their labors. This is one of the things. It's very easy, especially with older teens, and when you have a lot, you know, you have a household, and you have them, and they're doing all sorts of free labor for you, and then someone offers them independence and reward for their labor. We need to think of ways, how can they feel rewarded and benefited by what I'm asking them to do? What's the payoff we're offering them? We need to put ourselves in their shoes and think through that. So our fundamental goal for this season is to give them independence, to bring them up to a responsible independence. So that's the training goal. Brittany?
One quick thing that I also wanted to bring up was dealing with sorrow as a teenager in a healthy way. And there's a temptation, obviously, and especially when your kids are younger, then you do protect them from horrible things. And, you know, if somebody dies in your family, like a grandparent dies, they do know about it. But there's a limit to how much they process and stuff, especially if they're really young and they don't have a relationship yet really with that person. But as they grow and as they experience sorrow, whether it's within your family or within friends, and maybe they don't keep the best company and their friends make some unwise choices and potentially deal with some big consequences, helping them to process through that healthy and not ignore the process, skip over it, or try to numb it with different things. Just from my own family experience, my grandmother experienced tragedy, trauma at a young age, a young adult age, and never really recovered from it. And so the maturity wasn't there. If part of how you gain maturity isn't having a sunny, rainbow-filled life.
Yeah, so I think that's really, really important to not shield them completely from the consequences and from the consequences that others are experiencing so that they can see that, because, you know, their actions are going to have consequences like that too, for sure. I think that, like, helping them deal with the sorrow even of seeing pain and suffering in other people's lives is really helpful. So the goal of the previous, so moving on to training procedures, and just a few points as we come to the end here. The goal of the previous stages of parenting is to get to a place by the teen years where you can truly be received as a shepherd in their life, willingly received as a shepherd in their life, in order to lead them into adulthood and then launch them into the world. Authority versus influence, we touched on this earlier, but it's so important indeed. If you walk away from this course of all these lessons and you only pick up one thing, this would be pretty high on the list of the difference between authority and influence in your children's lives. Tripp says this: authority in this chart, he has a chart in the book, denotes what may be accomplished with your child because you are stronger, faster, larger, and so forth. Influence represents the willingness of your child to place himself under your authority because he trusts you. Your role as an influence is one of helping him to know his needs and be honest with himself. As a parent seeking to shepherd a teenager, you want to influence your child to respond to things that are reasonable, drawn from insight into human character based on Scripture. You're seeking to influence and provide counsel. You can accomplish nothing of lasting value simply by being an authority. You must seek to counsel and influence. And so I think what he's saying there, by simply by being authority, the fact that you have authority, there'll come a point when even your authority, when they leave your home, you are no longer an authority in their lives in the way that you once were. But you still ought to be able to influence them because they still need you. And so one of the tests of parenting is, on the one hand, are your children ready to live independent lives? Are they still, you know, holding mommy's apron strings? That's not healthy. But as someone who has the maturity to live as an adult, have you taught them to honor you, to respect you, and to value your continued influence in their lives? We're not called to manage our children. We're called to raise up adults. By the time you get to the teen years, you really don't want to be setting rules at all. If rules are all you have, You are in deep trouble. As Tripp puts it, I am convinced that there are few times when a parent must demand that teens do or don't do something. In the cases where every day is made up of demanding and requiring, parents have not practiced biblical principles. The son or daughter who is expected to respond to demands and requirements is probably circumventing them and doing what he or she desires anyhow. If all you have is rules, you ain't got rules. Because your teens have a lot more time to think up of how to get around your rules than you'd have as to how to lay them down so they can't be gotten around. So, we need to be prepared to become an influence in our children's life, and increasingly so as they come to adulthood. We need to be prepared, secondly, to shepherd them through doubt. Tripp says this, there'll be times of doubt and question in the life of any young person raised in a Christian home. Part of internalization is becoming self-conscious of faith. Every young person goes through some period in which he or she examines the claims of Christian faith at arm's length, as it were. When we face with this, we need to not panic. We need to not act shocked or worse, personally offended, that they would dare to go through a season of doubt and concern. Not only that, but we should actively prepare our children for seasons of struggle. And one of the ways that we do that is by not, we talked about this when we talked about the stage of childhood, is by not pointing them for their assurance of salvation. You prayed this prayer, you went through this ritual, therefore you're saved. That's setting that doubt up to be twice as destructive as it otherwise would be. Instead, from the time that they're born until the time we breathe our last breath, we should point them to Jesus and teach them the gospel, because Jesus is the one who saves. And if they're looking back to an experience that they had, and they're looking back, the fact is, many, in fact, realistically, most children who grow up in a Christian home aren't going to know exactly when the faith became real for them. When you push through the frameworks that people set up for themselves and you actually get to hear someone's spiritual journey, that is the norm. They hear the gospel, they respond to it. They hear the gospel, they respond to it. They hear the gospel, they respond to it. And at some point that is often unknown both to their parents and to them, something clicks. And it's no longer just the parents teaching them how to be Christians, but it's the Spirit of God at work in their hearts independently of the parents. And what we want to do as parents when our children go through seasons of doubt is not tell them, you know, you prayed that prayer 5 years ago. You can't doubt. I was the one who led you to the Lord. You can't get this wrong. No. Don't point them to you. No, I remember. You may have forgotten that profession of faith, but I remember it. Don't point them to you and your memory as their security before God. Point them to Jesus. Always, always, always point them to Jesus. And if they have questions, and if they have doubts, don't freak out. Be willing to put the work in. Act like you believe the gospel is really true. If you're willing to die for the gospel, why should you be threatened by a 13-year-old's questions? What kind of faith is that? The gospel can stand up to the questions, even if you don't have the answers to them. It's one of the things that the pastors are here for, is to help you, equip you, and if you're like, hey, my kid has these questions, I don't know how to answer them, well, come talk to one of the pastors. And you know what? It may be that they have questions that we don't have the answers to. And sometimes it will be, ain't nobody got the answer to that question, but we can trust the character of God. But sometimes there are really good answers, and people have even written books about it. And you might have to put some work into it, and you may have to read something or watch something or do something with them, but take their questions seriously, but don't take them as a threat. Shepherd them through these years. So, shepherding through doubt. Positive interaction, number three. They're going to make mistakes, big mistakes, mistakes that have consequences. And you have to maintain a positive relationship with them, if at all possible. You must not help them to evade responsibility. That came up in the discussion. But you must also restrain your natural desire to berate them for their folly. The fact is, your young adults are going to do some really dumb things. And you're going to want to say, "What were you thinking? That's so dumb. You're so dumb. I would never have been so..." Well, I guess I was. But we're going to be tempted to berate them, to try to get them to feel the seriousness of what they've done. You're berating them is not going to get them to feel the seriousness of what they did, but it will ensure that they won't listen to anything you say. Mocking and demeaning language has never persuaded anyone. Ever. Of anything good. As Tripp puts it, I'm not talking about shielding them from responsibility. I'm not talking about insulating them from the effects of their errors of judgment. Those are important lessons when handled constructively. What I have in view is parental interaction that is full of hope and courage. This interaction is able to turn a fiasco into an opportunity to learn and go forward. You can't afford to berate your teens with destructive speech. Now, there's a time for strong language to say, "You need to turn from what you're doing," right? But when everything's fallen apart, that's not the time to say, "I told you so, you worthless loser. You'll never amount to anything." That's not going to help, ever. The young person, Tripp goes on, who is told he is worthless, no good, a loser, a slob, or a bum, will probably live up to his parents' expectations. And if he doesn't, those words will mark him or her for life. And they will haunt them. And they will not help them. The Proverbs tell us that pleasant words promote instruction. The wise in heart are called discerning, and pleasant words promote instruction. Pleasant words grease the wheels of instruction. A later verse underscores the same lesson. Pleasant words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. And so even in a difficult situation, do everything that is in your power to maintain a positive thrust to your message. The letter to the Hebrews is such a perfect example of this, because Hebrews has very strong words for the believers who are tempted to turn from Christ. But in the middle of all of this strong language, what does the writer say? Hebrews 6, 9. "But beloved, we are persuaded better things of you and things that accompany salvation, though we thus speak." And that has to be the hallmark of our speech to our young adults. Warn them about the dangers of destruction. Warn them about their selfishness or their folly or the bad choices they're making. Absolutely. But let them know you have some hope for them. And even if you struggle to gin up any hope for them, don't tell them that. Because that's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if it isn't, it'll only destroy any hope of relationship that you might have as an opportunity to influence them. Number next, developing an adult relationship. At 16, they're closer to being adults than they are to being young children. So we need to increasingly apply the same principles to our relationships with our older teenagers in particular that we would to our relationship with our other adult friends. So the closer they get to being adults, if our goal is to have an adult relationship with them, then the more the principles we would apply to our relationships with other adults will apply to our relationships with our children. Number one, wait for the right time. Tripp says this, "In regular friendship relationships, you would never jump on your friend, you shouldn't, the moment you saw him do something you questioned the wisdom of or something you thought was wrong. So long as his life was not endangered, or someone else's life, I suppose, you would not pounce on him about everything you saw him do or heard him say. You would bide your time, waiting for the proper moment." Do your teenagers need less consideration? So, if you had an adult friendship, you would wait for the right time to address something. It wouldn't be as soon as you saw them say something out of line, you jump on them. If that's what you do, then maybe that's a clue why you don't have any adult friends. Because you do that, you jump on people every single time they do something, you will have short-lived friendships. Number two, you deal with broad themes. In adult relationships, you don't nitpick your friends over every little thing that needs attention. Again, you shouldn't. Again, if you do, your friendships are likely to be shallow or short-lived or both. Rather, you look for broad themes of response. You try to understand the patterns of response, and that's what you talk about. Again, with our adult friends, we allow room for disagreement. In adult relationships, Tripp says, it's possible to disagree with one another and remain friends. The same should be true in your relationships with your children. They don't have to agree with you on everything in order to respect you. Your children, even as adults, ought always to honor and respect you. But the older they get, the less necessary it is for that respect to take the form of complete agreement with you on every point. And if you insist, if you don't agree with me on everything, bless God, you don't respect me at all, that's only going to drive them away. It's not going to get them to agree with you on everything, unless you want to crush their spirit and destroy their ability to function in the world independently of you. Sometimes, Tripp says, parents fail to distinguish between what is scriptural and what reflects their personal taste. And things such as dress, hairstyle, and so forth, it's possible for honest people to disagree. Look around. Many different hairstyles among us. There are many areas in which you need to draw in the reins and give clear direction to your teens. Don't waste your influence on things that don't matter. That may mean they wear some bizarre costumes from time to time. Don't worry, people will forget, and their faltering and experimenting will settle in time. They needn't be carbon copies of you to be godly. Remember, the teen years are supposed to be years of increasing independence. Rather than insisting they do everything the way you do it, you should be finding safe areas for them to experience some genuine independence, and sometimes some areas to reap the consequences of independence in ways that don't destroy their lives. Finally, beyond internalization, we should want our children to surpass us. We shouldn't just want. So when we are trying to bring our children up to be adults, there comes a point when we are trying to help them launch. When you shoot an arrow, what does it do?
Spins.
Who said that? Follows a parabolic trajectory. But it does really more basic than that. It's absolutely basic. If I were to shoot an arrow, would it land behind me? Well, it might if I was shooting it. But if a competent competent archer were to launch an arrow, would the arrow be behind them, where they are, or ahead of them? So our goal with our children should be to get them, to the best of our ability, to equip them to surpass us, and to not be jealous when that happens. To not be jealous when that happens. So we should want our children to develop a robust Christian mind. Robust abilities. So, in my own family, Petey's 9. And he's learning Greek. Because that's what I know how to teach. But the fact is, when I was 9, I didn't have anybody to teach me Greek. If Petey sticks with it, he will know Greek way better than I ever will. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And there are areas in your life right now you should be preparing yourself emotionally and spiritually for your children to be better than you. In fact, you should be preparing for your children to be better than you. That should be your goal, for them to go beyond you, to go as far beyond you as an arrow from a mighty longbow would go. So they need to develop a Christian mind and develop abilities and skills and all of those things. They should learn how to develop friendships with adults. You need friends, they need friends. They need mentors. You don't have every skill that they need. And so you should be helping them to pick the right sort of adult to develop friendships with. You should help them to discover and to develop the ministry niche, the spiritual gifts that they have. You should help them to find a career or a calling in which they can fulfill the cultural mandate and God's command that they support themselves and share with others in need. And it may be that you have in mind, hey, if you follow in my footsteps, you get a solid job. And it may be that they're more entrepreneurial. And they're bored to death by following in your footsteps. And they've got this vision and this plan. It may be that you have this vision and this plan to be so entrepreneurial. And that's what you want for them. But that's not who they are. They're the kind of person that shows up day in, day out, week in, week out, and is faithful. And that's a good thing too. So when we're thinking about where they're going to end up, we need to think about where that kind of arrow is best suited to go, not just about the capacities of the bow that's shooting. Because every arrow, every child, every young adult is distinct, and we want to be equipping them to the best of their capability. In establishing their own home and family identity as a member of the society and a part of the Church of Christ, where they are able to set up their own household, that's our goal. They are their own household, and they are a center of godliness for everyone around them. And lastly, we need to entrust our children to God. The parenting task comes to an end, Tripp says. We are no longer the on-site shepherds. And that aspect of our relationship is done. And this will be true whether they marry or just take their place as an adult in their community. God intends for parenting to be a temporary task. It's a permanent relationship. You will always be their parents. You should always pray for them. You should always be there for them. But you should not always be trying to raise them. And there comes a point where you've done all the raising you're going to do. And the more you keep trying, the more harm you'll cause. And so you take your hands off. You stop, you know, trying to get behind the car and push. And you let them go on their own steam. And when they need help, you're there for them. And you may confront them about things like you would any other adult, because of the relationship you have with them, maybe more than you would with other adults. You're there for them, but you're no longer treating them like kids because they aren't kids anymore. And the hope is that if we follow this process and we shepherd our children's hearts and we bring up our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, we can bring them up so that they're no longer children, but responsible adults who are able to do the same thing again every generation there is until Christ returns. I'd love to have some more discussion, but we're out of time, so let's pray. Father, I come before you. I thank you for the opportunity to have taught on this important topic. I pray, Father, in my own home, I would put the lessons that have been taught into practice, and that each of us would do the same, and we would raise up a generation that would be equipped to flourish for God's glory. Christ's name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading it for yourself.